Welcome to History 605, South Dakota State Historical Society's podcast, where we talk to historians, curators, filmmakers, artists, and authors about how they interpret the past.
10,000 years from now, I think we can meditate and wonder whether our descendants, because I think they'll still be here, what they will think about us. And let us hope that at least they will give us the benefit of the doubt.
I'm Dr. Ben Jones, South Dakota State Historian and Director of the State Historical Society. Join me and our guests as we think historically.
So it is most appropriate and fitting that in our first year of our second century that this should also be a year of reconciliation between the Indian people and the non-Indian people alike.
History 605 is sponsored by the Gruver Family Trust and done in partnership with South Dakota Public Broadcasting. Welcome to the show.
June 25th will be the 150th anniversary of the Battle of Little Bighorn, or as the victors of that battle would refer to it, the Greasy Grass. Sandy Bernard, a scholar and researcher with decades of experience, joined us in 2021 to discuss his book on George Custer. Sandy has a new book out on the history of how the battle has been remembered and commemorated. We've seen a great deal of activity this year in the ramp-up and marking the 150th anniversary, which occurred in eastern Montana. Bernard explains much of what makes Custer, a complicated man who has fascinated Americans since his days as a Civil War general, still a point of great historical interest. While this show and his 2020 book is a replay, we hope to get Sandy on soon for his recent book, Celebrating Custer's Last Stand, 150 Years Commemorating the Battle of the Little Bighorn. In the meantime, I hope you enjoy this conversation about one of our nation's most controversial and colorful military leaders.
Today we have with us Sandy Bernard as an author whose special focus his whole life has been on George Custer, the Plains Indian Wars, and the Frontier Army. He has done several projects for the National Park Service and edited the newsletter The Greasy Grass, or the annual magazine The Greasy Grass of the Custer Battlefield Historical Museum Association. Certainly George Armstrong Custer is most famous for his dramatic death in a ferocious battle in June of 1876 against the Lakota and Cheyenne. But the man's life was larger than that fateful day, and so today, Sandy Bernard is on the show with us to discuss his new book, George Armstrong Custer, A Military Life, published recently by South Dakota Historical Society Press. Thanks for joining us on History 605 today, and I'm wondering if you could begin by asking, what are the myths that you've had to contend with about Custer the man? Not the battles necessarily, but as this is a biography, what are the common notions about him that are just plain mistaken?
As with most human beings, George Custer was both a positive individual and a negative individual. He had his flaws, of course, and somehow by being defeated in his last battle, losing the good part of his command and all, and in fact losing that battle against Native Americans, that battle has tended to dominate his historical record in his career, as if he were some kind of fool. And that's really not the case, especially when you look at the man for his entire career. He was one of the best generals, actually, as a cavalry officer during the Civil War. And even though he graduated last in his class, that didn't really matter once a man is on the battlefield. I was thinking of this just the other day when the major leagues teams drafted all those players, and some went very high in the draft. And I noticed that the Boston Red Sox the other day signed two kids who weren't even drafted. They have just as much of a chance of making the major leagues as the kids who were drafted in the top 10. And so the same thing was basically true with the officers who came out of West Point in that era. Custer may have finished last, but he was among the best of the officers who graduated from West Point in 1861.
Okay. So his class graduates just as the war is beginning, or actually his class was kind of truncated, right, in timeline? Weren't they graduated early?
It was supposed to be a five-year class, but with the war breaking out, the military academy sped things up, and so there were actually two classes that graduated in 1861, and his was the second.
I see.
The expanding Union Army needed second lieutenants.
Yes. So he goes into the Union Army, serving alongside and opposite many former classmates. What's his first few jobs, and how does he rise so quickly?
He was one of those people who, in some respects, never served as a company grade officer, that is, leading a platoon mm-hmm. or leading a company. He ended up working for a series of very prominent generals, Philip Kearny first, and then George McClellan, of course, was the commander of the Army of the Potomac. He went on to serve with General Alfred Pleasanton, and it was Pleasanton in 1863, just before Gettysburg, who would elevate Custer to brigadier general, primarily because Custer had proved himself as a staff officer. In fact, he often, on the battlefield, even though he was a staff officer, would lead troops in the charge. And so he impressed every one of his officers that he had worked with, senior officers.
Mm-hmm.
And so it really isn't surprising that when Pleasanton took over the cavalry force for the Army of the Potomac in June of 1863, that he chose Custer among several officers for the rank of brigadier general and to lead brigades.
So how old is he then when he becomes a brigadier general?
He's among the youngest in the Army at that point.
Right.
He's only about 23 years old. And in my own life, I like to note that at age 23, I too was an Army captain. But I didn't rise to brigadier general.
Right. So a cavalry brigade, how many troops is that this 23-year-old is in charge of?
At Gettysburg, he had about 2,200 to 2,500 men under him.
Uh-huh.
And that was an imposing force. The Michigan Cavalry Brigade that he
right.
was now commanding, in fact, would become one of the most elite units of the Army of the Potomac. And then he would go on to lead as a major general, about a year and a half later, he would lead the 3rd Cavalry Division, which also prospered under his command.
Right. So during his Civil War service, you think about the turnover in Union leadership. It's a constant. And he gets this job just before Gettysburg is about to happen. The commander of the Union, the entirety of the Union force is brand new into his job just as Gettysburg is about to happen.
Right.
Of course, General Lee on the other side is very comfortable in his position and has been doing that job since the outset of the war. Kind of set the scene for what Gettysburg, how it occurs and briefly, and then what it means to us today that the Union won that battle.
In many respects, the fact that the battle occurred at Gettysburg is simply just a happenstance.
Mm-hmm.
Troops just happened to meet there. They perhaps could have met any place in terms of where they were maneuvering. Lee had decided that he would take the war into the north,
mm-hmm.
and so he was had moved his troops across out of Virginia and across the Potomac into Maryland, and then had gone into Pennsylvania. And he was missing his cavalry force under General Jeb Stuart at that point, so he was kind of going forward blinded. In the meantime, General Meade had just been named as the commander of the Army of the Potomac.
Mm-hmm.
And so he hustled to gather his forces, and so they too moved toward where they thought that the Confederates would be, and that was going to be, by more coincidence than planning, at the small town of Gettysburg.
Mm-hmm.
Custer, in the meantime, had just taken over as commander of the Michigan Cavalry Brigade, and he had been ordered by his general to do several different things, one in Huntersville, one at Hanover. And at Huntersville, he almost found himself killed. He had led an attack and then was unhorsed, and an enlisted man saved him from being killed, and therefore we will go on to develop the legend.
Mm-hmm.
But at Hanover, he had fought well and against the troops of Jeb Stuart, as they too were maneuvering, trying to find Lee. But the real impressive battle that Custer will engage in will be what has become known as East Cavalry Field.
Mm.
And it happens on the third day, July 3rd, of the Battle of Gettysburg. The Confederate forces amass to charge across from Seminary Ridge to Cemetery Ridge in the so-called Pickett's Charge. In the meantime, the cavalry force under Stuart is going to try to come around from the rear and disrupt the Union force. And General John Gregg has his troops, and Custer has been attached to Gregg's force for the time being. Actually, Custer was recalled to go rejoin his general, Kirkpatrick, but because of the pending attack by the Confederates at East Cavalry Field, Custer stays put, and there's a large back-and-forth battle, several different charges by both sides,
mm-hmm.
and at least twice Custer grabs the command of a Pacific unit and gives the order, "Come on, you Wolverines," and he leads the attack against the Confederate force. Eventually, the Confederates will melt away. It's basically a draw, but in the sense that it's a victory for the Union, because Stuart was not able to disrupt the activities on the battlefield elsewhere as the infantry forces were colliding.
Right.
And Custer is not the only one who deserves praise for East Cavalry Field, but given that he's rather flamboyant and all, people certainly focus on him because of that. And it was a dynamic day for him.
Right. They didn't know it at the time, but Gettysburg proves to be a turning point in the war, kind of the phrase, the high watermark of the Confederacy. What, after the battle, what does Custer go on and do?
Well, he's involved with, there's a long, slow campaign as the Confederates retreat into Virginia,
mm-hmm.
and Custer is heavily involved in that particular effort. There's no one final battle there. The Confederates eventually make their way across the Potomac back into Virginia. And during the fall, Custer will be involved in several different campaigns. In September, he will actually be wounded at the Battle of Culpeper and will take some leave. It will be really in 1864 that he has his next true opportunities to gather battle scars and battle victories, as there's a long campaign beginning in May where the two forces are colliding in a series of engagements. In the meantime, General Sheridan has replaced General Pleasanton, and that will begin a relationship between Sheridan and Custer that will last until Custer's death.
Right.
But there are any number of battles across the spring and summer of 1864 where the Michigan Cavalry Brigade fights remarkably well time after time. At one battle, Trevilian Station, on June 11th of 1864, it's oftentimes referred to as Custer's first last stand. He saw a Confederate wagon train. He's sought to seize it. In the meantime, the Confederates surrounded him. And another book that I did about Lieutenant Edward Granger, an aide to Custer, Granger describes in great detail how Custer was responsible for the Michigan Cavalry Brigade holding its own until they were rescued. But as I said, the battle is oftentimes referred to as Custer's first last stand.
Mm-hmm.
Throughout May, June, July, and August into September, the Michigan Cavalry Brigade is a vaunted force.
Yes. Well, and his rise culminates actually in his, isn't he present at Appomattox when Lee surrenders his armies?
He's not in the room.
He's not in the room.
There are paintings that show him in the room. He actually did receive one of the surrender flags.
Okay.
He was not part of the group that met to discuss the terms of surrender.
Okay.
He was nearby with the third, and at that point he was a divisional commander.
Okay.
And so he was nearby with his division standing ready to fight if that proved necessary.
I see.
Which it did not, of course.
Well, with a person's rise so quickly and at such a young age, doesn't happen without its controversy, and I imagine he made some enemies within the Army. What did Grant think of him?
Well, at the time, Grant thought well of him.
Mm-hmm.
There was no reason for him not to. I mean, Custer was a general who delivered victory after victory.
Mm-hmm.
At one point in a letter to his sister, Lieutenant Granger refers to Custer as one of the fighting generals, someone that we read too much of too much and see too little.
Mm-hmm.
And, so Custer had no—I should say Grant had no reason to frown on Custer during the Civil War. It's later that Custer begins to take some steps that will lead to problems ultimately with the president.
Mm-hmm.
Very early, for example, he is, after the war has actually ended, but there are Confederate forces still at large in Texas. He is dispatched to Texas
mm-hmm.
with a makeshift division and takes some action against some of the volunteer troops who wanted to go home. And those actions are frowned upon by the Army command, including Grant.
Okay.
So that probably didn't endear him to Grant at that point. Whether that was a factor later is speculative here.
Yeah.
But it was really in the mid-1870s when Grant, as president, is maneuvering to open up or seize the Black Hills. And Custer is gives some testimony that implicates the president's brother about some post-traitorship scandals on the frontier post. And so Grant retaliates by removing him from command of what is called the Dakota Column that was going to go into action in May of 1876. And he also removes him from command of his then regiment, the 7th U.S. Cavalry. General Terry, as well as Sherman and Sheridan, intervene, and Custer is restored to command of the regiment, but not to the column. And part of the reason they were successful in having Custer restored is that Grant was being pummeled by the Democratic press, which is not too different from what happens today, of course.
Sure. You mentioned the Black Hills. Let's backtrack a little bit. He has this expedition in 1874 in the Black Hills. I wonder if you can share what that was about and kind of the impact of that. What were the results of that expedition for South Dakotans today?
Well, earlier you asked me about myths, and one of the myths that involves Custer is focused on the Black Hills.
Mm-hmm.
It's not as if Custer opened the Black Hills. The
Certainly.
Whites were going into the Black Hills and had been doing so for
mm-hmm.
decades.
Mm-hmm.
The Treaty of 1868, Fort Laramie Treaty, had guaranteed the Black Hills to the Native Americans, but there were rumors of gold there.
Right.
The Army under the treaty was authorized to have posts. It could actually patrol through the Black Hills.
Mm-hmm.
That's where part of the myth comes. It's as if Custer suddenly decided one day to go look for gold in the Black Hills.
Right.
He was given the command. He was ordered to go into the Black Hills, and he was there legally. Actually, in that particular case, he did not engage anyone, but he did explore it, and his stories that came back, as well as stories from others about the Black Hills, suggested that there was gold there. And that did set off the Black Hills Gold Rush. And that really opened the door to 1876 because the Indians were now insulted that the whites were trying to take the Black Hills from them. Mm-hmm. There were actually negotiations between the two sides that failed. Mm-hmm. And but that didn't stop the Grant administration from deciding that action should be taken. And so in late 1875, they would order the Indians to return to the reservations, but the Indians themselves had the rights to be there.
Right.
And it was also wintertime, so of course they could not and did not return to the several reservations that had been established. And in early February, the orders went forth to direct the army to go force the Indians to return to leave the Black Hills and leave the extended reservation out west.
Well, and
but again, Custer himself was following orders.
Right. It's difficult for us today to understand the meaning of gold in the economy. When the dollar is based on gold, it's essentially the source of all currency. And so when more gold is found or in some way added to the economy, in 1873, there's a severe recession hits the United States. So
right.
I think from Grant's point of view, he's trying to solve a recession, and there's a place that's got gold in it, and there's this pesky treaty standing in the way, and so he's trying to maneuver a different deal, it seems to me. But and ultimately then, of course, the Lakota, the Cheyenne, they don't want to negotiate a new treaty. They like the one they had, and so that begins the campaign for what becomes of which the Battle of the Little Bighorn is a part. I wonder if you could kind of paint a verbal picture for the listeners on the three prongs of the campaign and what was the point of the Battle of the Little Bighorn.
Well, as I had said earlier, the orders had gone forth to the army to force the Indians to return to the reservations. Mm-hmm. Whether that was a lawful order and all, we can debate that today, and it's still debated today, of course. But the officers of that period, it was a lawful order, and so there are several men involved in carrying that out, all of whom were Civil War veterans. Colonel John Gibbon is going to come from Fort Ellis from the west in Montana, Montana Territory, mm-hmm. and with a force. General George Crook, who is acknowledged as one of the better Indian fighters, is at Fort Fetterman in Wyoming Territory, and he's going to move north. And then originally Custer was going to leave what is called the Dakota Column from Fort Lincoln across the Missouri River at Bismarck. And because of the political fighting, the impeachment of the Secretary of War and all, Belknap, Custer will get in trouble with the president, as we talked earlier, mm-hmm. and fortunately will be reinstated to command his regiment. General Alfred Terry, another Civil War veteran and hero, will lead the Dakota Column. The plans are rather speculative. There is no one solid plan for them to meet at a particular point in a particular time. Mm-hmm. They're all kind of on their own. If they happen to run into one another, more power to them, but that's not part of the plan. So Crook moves first, and in March of 1876, some of his troops under Colonel Joseph Reynolds will attack a combined village at the Powder River. It will be a victory for the army initially, and then the warriors will retake the village. Reynolds will suffer the loss of his career later by virtue of a court-martial, but because of his failure to retain the village. Crook will then go back and resupply for the first time in the campaign. John Gibbon will come forth and will actually maneuver throughout Montana territory and will actually run into the Indians now and again, but not, he can't seem to force them to battle.
Mm-hmm.
And he doesn't really keep the rest of the army informed as to what he is seeing. That is, there are growing numbers of Indians. Mm-hmm. Finally, in May, the Dakota Column under Terry will set forth from Fort Lincoln. It was delayed by winter storms. And, of course, Custer is leading his 7th Cavalry. And in June, they will actually run into Gibbon. And they will begin to formulate some plans. There is a scout mission under Major Marcus Reno, who is sent out to try to find the Indian trail and see which direction they were going. And the rest of the troops, including Custer, kind of sit tight while that's going on. Unknown to the Army, to Terry and to Custer and to Gibbon, is that Crook has now come back into the field.
Mm-hmm.
He has about 1,500 soldiers and civilians, as well as Indian scouts.
Mm-hmm.
And he's making his way north. And he's takes stops on June 17th at the Rosebud for coffee. And in the meantime, here comes Crazy Horse with about 1,000 warriors.
Mm-hmm.
And this was kind of unheard of on the plains, that the Indians would attack that large a force.
Mm-hmm.
And there's an all-day battle, the Battle of the Rosebud. There's a very good book on that battle now, written by Paul Hedren. But the fight goes on all day. It is basically a draw. Crook still retains the field because the Indians withdraw, so he claims a victory, but it was basically a draw. And to the Indians' credit, Crook decides he shot up too much of his ammunition, so he's headed back
right.
to modern-day Sheridan to resupply, and he doesn't tell anyone about what has befallen him, that the warriors are much more aggressive, much more numerous,
yeah.
and that he himself has now taken himself off the trail.
Yeah.
And so Custer doesn't know that. This is 8 days before Custer himself will run into the Indians at Little Bighorn.
Well, it's quite a campaign filled with complexity and so forth, and of course the enemy gets a vote, and here it's folks like Crazy Horse and Sitting Bull, very effective and practiced warriors. What can you tell us about their motivations at that time that Custer assumed away? If you can understand where I'm going with that question, you've mentioned it a little bit about how the Crook might have been surprised that there was such a large force that was so willing to fight, in fact, attack him. What is the going assumption that Custer has as he's proceeding through with his column about the nature of what the Indians are thinking?
Oops, sorry for stepping on your tongue there.
Sure.
All of the troops, all of the leaders, I should say, have expected that the Indians will follow their normal path. That is, in the face of large numbers of soldiers, they will not stand and fight.
Mm-hmm.
That's why Crook was surprised when here came some 1,000 warriors attacking him. That mm-hmm. that should never happen. That's not in the book.
Mm-hmm.
And but he doesn't communicate that information, as I said, to the other officers. And so they expect maybe 500, maybe 1,000 warriors would be what they would face. And instead, there has been a steady outward flow of warriors and families away from the reservations and into the wilderness to join up with the Indians who are under Sitting Bull
mm-hmm.
and other tribal leaders. The village that will eventually gather on the Little Bighorn by June 25th will be a very large one.
Mm-hmm.
And it could have had as many as 1,500 to 2,500 warriors, and as many as perhaps 7,500 to 10,000 people.
Okay.
It would be one of the largest towns in Montana if it existed today.
Right.
And, but the soldiers do not know this, and when Reno makes his scout, he does discover signs that there are a lot more tent poles and the like headed west.
Mm-hmm.
And he does report that information, but again, it doesn't really worry Terry and the others, because they do not expect the Indians to stand and fight.
Mm-hmm.
And so Custer is then sent forth to go up the Rosebud looking for the Indians, with the idea that they could all meet on June 26th. That's not really a firm plan. That's another myth of Little Bighorn, is that Custer was definitely going to be in place at a certain time, and Terry was coming and mm-hmm. at a certain time, and they would catch the village. And yes, there would be a battle at a time and place that had now been designated. That wasn't quite what the plan said. Terry himself, with the given force, moves west along the Yellowstone and will eventually come up the Bighorn. And Custer is now moving up the Rosebud. And there are signs that there are a lot of Indians ahead. He has the word from his scouts that he will face more than he might have anticipated. He's still not worried. The Army is used to fighting Indians somewhat by this time, and a large force doesn't necessarily mean trouble. But Custer needs to know where they are, and so he's planning on June 25th to sit tight and locate them.
Mm-hmm.
But other signs indicate that maybe his force has been discovered, and he decides that he has to move forward, because one of the things the commanders all fear is that the warriors, the Indian villages themselves, will disperse, they'll scatter and not be able to be relocated.
Mm-hmm.
And so he doesn't want that to happen. So he then divides his force. That's not unusual. There's another mm-hmm. myth there that Custer should have kept his force together. He had learned his lesson at the Battle of the Washita 8 years before, which was a victory for him. He had divided his force into four different units, and it worked for the most part, except that a couple of the subunits didn't get into place quickly enough. But other commanders, notably Ranald McKenzie at the Palodoro Canyon, had attacked Indian forces with just several hundred troops, while the warriors may have numbered 1,500, and he too won. So it's not something that is unusual in terms of the way the Army fought at the time. It's not unusual for them to be unfazed by the number of warriors they could face. So
mm-hmm.
he tells Captain Benteen to go to the southwest, just in case there are Indian camps farther up the Little Bighorn. That's what happened to Custer at the Washita. There were other villages downstream of the Washita.
Mm-hmm.
He keeps Reno and the other troops under Reno with him, and they head forth down the Rosebud. And then at one point, they think the Indians are now breaking. And so he orders Major Reno to attack, and he will be supported.
Mm-hmm.
Custer's discredit, he doesn't tell Reno exactly what that means.
Yeah.
Was he going to follow Reno into the village from behind Reno or from some other direction? Well, turns out it must have been from some other direction, because he himself goes north along the bluffs, and Reno finds himself alone in the valley, and suddenly there are far more warriors than anybody expected.
Mm-hmm.
And those warriors begin to close in along his skirmish line, force him to scatter into the what's called the timber, and eventually flush them from the timber and force them to back to the bluffs across the Little Bighorn, where they will set up a defensive perimeter. Custer himself has gone north. He makes a movement toward the Little Bighorn at Medicine Tail Coulee. That used to be the idea that Custer was trying to attack there, but most historians today think that was more of a feint. Custer mm-hmm. has probably spotted the women and children going north, And that's how he won at the Ouachita. He seized the women and children. So he is going to try to seize the women and children. So he continues north and begins to subdivide his command. He has a couple of companies under a couple of lieutenants at one end of the field, while he takes three more farther north. He keeps at Last Stand Hill, and some troops go forth trying to get across the river to seize the women and children, but they will be repulsed, and that begins to turn the tide at Little Bighorn.
What's the point of...
Too scattered.
Yeah.
And cannot hold against the significant number of warriors who are now infiltrating around him.
Right. You know, as you drive west on I-90, you drive right past that battlefield. It's rather striking to see the hill and the terrain around there. When he comes up over the ridge and sees the numbers that he's really contending with now, is it at that point where he has to drop all his assumptions and realize, oh, there's more than I thought, and perhaps they will stand and fight? What do you think, having studied this battle and this man for so long, when did he sense that other calamity was about to occur?
One of the most fun projects I have been involved in with regard to the Little Bighorn was in the 90s with two other historians, Jim Brust and Brian Pohanka. And Brian is now deceased, but he had a great mind for not only the Indian Wars, but for other military actions. And he was of the opinion that Custer himself never was fazed by any of this.
Mm-hmm.
And as I, in my last two books, including the Granger book and now the Custer biography itself, one of the things I've come away from with doing the research and writing is that Custer, one of his strengths is that he did not fear death. Men who are going into combat worry about that for the most part. But Custer himself had no fear.
Mm-hmm.
He was not motivated in a negative fashion by the fear that he might lose, that he might die.
Mm-hmm.
And so when he came over the ridge for the first time and observed how large the village actually was, he actually probably thought, now I can attack and force them to surrender and go back to the reservation.
Right.
He believed that he, even with his small force, could force the action. And it's only on Last Stand Hill begins to probably realize that's not going to happen. The force that he sent to the river is repulsed.
Mm-hmm.
The forces under Lieutenant Calhoun back at Calhoun Ridge are now falling.
Mm-hmm.
Captain Keogh's company was in reserve, and it too was falling.
Mm-hmm.
And at that moment, when I think Custer realizes that the jig is up.
Right.
But prior to that, and this is something Brian Pohanka used to make clear too, that Custer was always on the offense. And if you think back to the Granger account of Trevilian Station, what he shows Custer doing at that time is constantly in motion.
Mm-hmm.
He was not defeated until he was defeated.
Right.
And he kept fighting and fighting and fighting. And, of course, at Trevilian Station, relief forces did reach him.
Mm-hmm.
At Little Bighorn, they did not.
Right.
He had recalled Benteen, and Benteen only made it as far as Reno. Position on the bluffs.
Mm-hmm.
The two men had gone forward, but for whatever reason, they didn't go beyond what's called Weir Point. And, Custer's, and of course, Terry was too far up the Bighorn yet to come to his rescue. And Custer lost because nobody rescued him, from his own mistakes in that respect.
Right. Given that people at the time, a lot of people adored him. A lot of people loved him. He was a national celebrity of the day. A lot of people hated him. A lot of people inside the Army hated him. How do you proceed from that as a historian then to kind of sift through the sources of who loves him, who respects him, who hates him, and make sense of what the truth might be?
The Army of that period had strange rules for promotions, unlike today.
Mm-hmm.
And so therefore, there was a lot of backbiting at the time. And so somebody who was truly successful may have incurred the wrath of his brother officers. Custer wasn't so much hated, I think, in one respect, but people were jealous of his success.
Right.
And, but even Custer himself could not advance any faster than anyone else. When the Army was expanded in 1866, he was able to go from being a regular Army captain again to a lieutenant colonel. That was partly based on his war record, but he stayed there. He had to wait.
Yeah.
The only way you got promoted in those days was for a man to die or retire.
Mm-hmm.
And Custer was still down the list even at the time of his death. And so there were a lot of people, therefore, who were jealous of him. And I think that at the time that jealousy was rather superficial. I think only in across the almost 145 years since the battle have people formulated these ideas that he wasn't liked and that people mm-hmm. were out to get him and all. For the most part, that's not true.
Okay.
Custer was simply another officer in the military. And, mm-hmm. The idea that he, for example, woke up one morning on June 25th and decided to go out and shoot some Indians is what you can hear from people,
mm-hmm.
but that's not the case. He was there because the U.S. Army and the Grant administration put him there.
Right. I think that's one point that comes out in your book, is that he is very much a soldier, following orders, doing his job. And he's just kind of, he looks at things in a very utilitarian way. Would you say that?
Right.
Yeah.
And, the discussions of the last several days about General Milley with regard to Trump and whether Trump might pull a coup are interesting, because he proved himself once again, in this case, to be as Milley did, to be a soldier.
Right.
Someone who was responsible basically to upholding the Constitution. And I don't know why people historically have decided that Custer was more than that. He was no homicidal maniac.
Right.
Yeah, he had a desire for flamboyancy.
Yep.
He was ambitious.
Yep.
I worked 30 years in the academic world, and there's nothing more ambitious than a college professor.
Right.
And it's, even when I was teaching, I would tell my students, you don't go into an interview, and when they ask you where you want to be in 10 years, well, you'd like to start at the bottom and go down.
Right. Right.
The proper answer is you want to be dean or president someday.
Right. Well, I usually like to end these interviews with, so what's the best question? You animate the book about with questions about Custer. What would you, kind of along the lines of what you were just saying, what would you tell readers or students about the best question and is useful from learning about Custer's life for applying to our situation today?
Well, Custer, I guess that's a hard question to answer, because what happens with Custer is that he finds himself stuck in our modern era. In fact, I have a line in the book. I often wear a ball cap for showing my Vietnam status, and mm-hmm. people will come up to me and shake my hand and thank me for serving at the time.
Mm-hmm.
I've even had a couple of people pick up my checks, unbeknownst to me.
Right, right.
Because I was wearing a Vietnam ball cap.
Mm-hmm.
But I like to say, and I have a line in the book, that Custer and the 7th Cavalry are still wandering on the plains. They haven't been invited back home yet.
Right.
And that's because, of course, they fought a minority whose rights have been under much discussion in our society today, as with most minorities.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so Custer gets dismissed basically as an arrogant, militaristic, homicidal maniac who wore a military uniform. And Custer was not that.
Mm-hmm.
He was somebody who aspired to have a career. His parents recognized that he was more than just a farm boy, so they made certain he was well-educated for the times. He went to West Point, became an Army officer, and that's what he was on June 25th, 1876. He had sworn an oath to uphold the Constitution like any Army officer, and he was doing his duty.
Mm-hmm.
And that duty today is often tied up with the political question as to whether it was fair on the part of the U.S. government to have sent him there.
Right.
But that's a different question from who the man Custer was.
Right. Well, Sandy, thank you very much, and congratulations on the book.
Thank you.
The Sandy Bernard, author of the recent book, George Armstrong Custer, A Military Life.
We'd like to thank Howard and Dorothy Gruer for their passion for history and the support of the South Dakota State Historical Society. It's through gifts such as theirs that we're able to tell South Dakota's history.
When a tornado hits a town, I've never been able to figure out which houses were the Democrats, or the Republicans, or the Libertarians. I never knew who the Norwegians were, or the Swedes, or the Czechoslovakians, or the Germans. Of course, everybody wants to point out who the Irish are, but other than that,
History 605 is produced by the South Dakota State Historical Society, and its audio engineer is the amazing Kevin Larson. We'd like to thank our partner, South Dakota Public Broadcasting, and most importantly, we'd like to thank you for listening. Please rate us on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to fine podcasts. We'll be back in a couple weeks with another episode of History 605.